Hello, I'm Tom Bowers. This is number 0370, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0370. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Tony Hendra, who is the mastermind behind the first National Lampoon album release in 35 years. It's called Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight? It tackles political correctness head on.
This is definitely an album which is directed at what people unfortunately call political correctness, which is a term I dislike intensely since it was invented by neoconservatives. But nonetheless, it is certainly about campus, recurrent and now again occurring phenomenon of campus oversensitive, I'd say, about many things that they're probably encountering for the first time.
Paul J.J. Payak from the Global Language Monitor on the Olympic Ambush Competition. That's non-sanctioned advertisers who horn in on the game's advertising dollars.
Nike took the gold, as one might expect. Pepsi took the silver, and Siemens took the bronze. Those are pretty strong competitors, and there's a lot of money involved with them. We also, this year, created the economic value unit on how much worth of advertising they actually get by ambushing. So somebody like Nike, it's about $400 million to sponsor an Olympiad. So the fact that Nike beat all the major sponsors except Samsung is a lot of money.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter looks at the courageous story of former Olympic swimmer Shirley Babashoff with Making Waves. So be on your mark, get set, and go right here on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0370 was Tom Bowers, who was a voice actor, musician, and co-host of a number of podcasts, including The Spoon and Super Enthusiast Radio. Those are just two. There are several others. Let's just say he podcasts around. Yeah. Thank you very much, Tom, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Police say a Florida man asking if a bulletproof vest still worked was fatally shot by his cousin. A Tampa police report says 23-year-old Joaquin Mendez put on the vest and wondered aloud whether it still worked. Police say his cousin, 24-year-old Alexandro Garibaldi, pulled out a gun and responded, "Let's see." Oh yeah, famous last words, huh? Officers found Mendez outside the house with a gunshot wound in his chest. Mendez died at the hospital. According to the report, Garibaldi initially told officers he found his wounded cousin after hearing a gunshot. However, police say a witness described Garibaldi shooting Mendez. Police say the vest was found inside the house with a gunshot in it. Yeah, the Darwin file, because the tree of life is always self-pruning. Plus, never ask questions out loud that could easily be deemed your last words. Yeah. A man was arrested on a charge of stalking after allegedly mailing dead animals to a teacher who was hired instead of the suspect, according to police in Indiana. French Lick police said that they have arrested 40-year-old Travis Terrence after being accused of harassing the new teacher and his fiance. Terrence was charged with stalking, intimidation, and criminal mischief. According to the police investigation, Terrence applied for a teaching job at the Springs Valley School Corporation. His application was rejected, and school officials hired another man. Terrence immediately began harassing the new teacher and his fiance. He mailed the couple multiple dead animals, including skunks and raccoons. Terrence then sent multiple letters to the school claiming the new teacher was having sex with a 15-year-old girl. He then left a voicemail on the couple's phone threatening to kill the fiancé and her baby. Okay, perhaps we're learning why this teacher was rejected for the job in the first place. Maybe he didn't finish or pass the psych evaluation. Just a guess. Also, I don't know what the rules are at the U.S. Postal Service, but how do you go about mailing multiple dead animals? And clearly, this is the ultimate case of being a sore loser. A customer at the Little Red Barn Steakhouse in San Antonio, Texas, was apparently dissatisfied with his meal. He was a larger man, so he was on top of the waiter, beating him up pretty bad, said Crystal Halliday, a diner who witnessed the incident. I believe he also hit him with a computer that was there at the hostess stand. Once someone got the customer and waiter separated, the customer got on top of the hostess's stand, according to Halliday. That's when the waiter pulled a gun and fired 3 shots into the ceiling. Both the customer and the waiter ran, and both could face charges, police say. Okay, I'm not quite sure why the waiter ran, but all I have to say is this is a story that involves a gun and the state of Texas. No further explanation is necessary. And by the way, I think I'm going to stay out of the Little Red Barn Steakhouse if I ever go to San Antonio. Just saying. Apparently the customers aren't happy there. Police are looking for a man who dresses up as a delivery driver with a Pepsi logo on his shirt and drives his car to stores in Prattville, Alabama. Once he enters a store, he stacks cases of beer and sodas on a cart, about 25 cases at a time, notes a police advisory. He then pushes the cart out of the store as if he is restocking the shelves. Their suspect, 22-year-old Darius Williams, is wanted for at least 4 counts of theft. Because it makes sense to store managers that delivery drivers pick up rather than, well, deliver, right? Clearly, the stores where Darius pulls this stunt aren't stocked with the brightest staff. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Hutan Imami bought a house in Colorado Springs. He bought it at auction, and when he was finally able to go inside, he ran out. He found the body of the previous homeowner inside. Neighbors said that after the husband of the household died, the wife disappeared. A neighbor and I got really sad and concerned because she was a great person, so we called the police department to come on down and do an investigation, says Gus Marquez. He said that was about 15 months ago, and he called again 8 months ago. An officer went to the door, knocked, and left when there was no answer. Because that's the best way to find out if someone is dead, right? Just knock on the door. No further investigation needed. Although, correct me if I'm wrong, but dead people rarely do answer the door, do they? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? National Lampoon has just released their first original album in more than 35 years. It's entitled, Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight? The album was created by Key Lampoon veteran Tony Hendra and the team at the Final Edition Radio Hour. Tony joins us on the line right now from New York to talk about the new album. Hi, Tony.
Hello, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for doing this. There are so many things to talk about when talking about this album, starting with the very title, Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight? And the reason why I bring up the title is, as someone who is a satirist and as someone who's been doing it for quite a long time, do you find it's more difficult these days in this politically correct time to get satire out there that is appreciated?
I don't know about that. I mean, it's one of the great things about the internet and all things digital is that you can do it yourself. So people can complain if they like, but it's not like you have to go through a distribution company or a record company like you used to have to. So, this is definitely an album which is directed at what people unfortunately call political correctness, which is a term I dislike intensely, since it was offended by neoconservatives. But nonetheless, it is certainly about campus, the recurrent and now again occurring phenomenon of campus sensitivities, about oversensitivity, I'd say, about many things that they're probably encountering for the first time.
Chicken or egg?
Triggers in this particular. Have you listened to the album?
Yeah, I've listened to part of it. I've just finished listening to about three quarters of it, as a matter of fact.
Great. Okay. Well, I mean, then, as you probably appreciate, triggers is an ambiguous term in this title, because it means both trigger warnings, and it also means the 300 million guns in the United States, which all have triggers, and which many of which have itchy fingers on them, and which probably we should be just as concerned about as whether somebody is committing a microaggression. So that's sort of the satirical point of this album.
Chicken or egg question, the whole politically correct situation, this whole idea of triggers, and you mentioned college campuses. Is this a situation where society has somewhat changed, or is it generational, that the next generation of human beings don't have the same kind of sense of humor as everyone else did before them?
Well, I think that's possible, but I mean, I must say, I haven't encountered... Well, let me backtrack. Can I start this bit again? I have to say that most of our cast is a half my age, and some of them are a third of my age. And they seem they're producing this stuff. I mean, to some degree under my tutelage, and sort of with my permission to be as satirically forceful as they want. And I don't really think that humor changes much. People try to say it does, but it doesn't. And the phenomenon that we're encountering on campus now was just as bemoaned in the 90s with the last generation, and it was bemoaned in my day, but in a much more hostile way. It wasn't called political correctness. It was just suppressed and oppressed. So I don't think these issues have gone away. Race has not gone away. Class has not gone away. Elitism in general has not gone away. Sexism has certainly not gone away. So, but they're recurrent issues, and they have recurrent phenomena when young people get hold of them and perhaps overreact to them.
It's been, as I said in the introduction, it's been 35 years since the last National Lampoon album has come out. Now that
right.
This one is out, are there any triggers here tonight? Why such a long span between albums?
Well, primarily because for the last 20-odd years, the Lampoon has been run by morons and criminals. The brand, as we unfortunately call it, is very much in disarray, or has been, until it was taken over by its current proprietors, who have set out quite courageously, I think, to try and reinvigorate what was once a sort of major hub of cutting-edge humor. So I met them in connection with something I want to do, which is to revive a landmark show that I did for the Lampoon called Lemmings. And since then, we've been kind of collaborating together, since they don't really have any content creators. We've been collaborating together to do various projects together with the National Lampoon name on them, but with the final edition being, in effect, the executive of any idea that we come up with. So this is the first one that's really on the market, and it's the final edition that is, you know, from beginning to end, the creative core of this, and are responsible for what some people have already called the Lampoon-likeness of the album. And my intention with the final edition, and indeed throughout my career, has been to continue the kind of satire that I did at the National Lampoon, funny, smart, well-informed, and not afraid of offending anyone, especially the right people.
Well, now that the album has come out and I'm still digesting, and even though I'm still digesting it, I'm hoping it's not another 35 years before another one comes out, because frankly, I don't know if I can wait that long.
No, it won't be. If this one goes, the final edition will certainly have the means, and we have certainly the talent to do more than just another album. But that's the story of why the Lampoon hasn't really done an original album. It's done retakes and compendiums and so on, but it hasn't done an actual original album since I think 1981. This is more in the spirit of the first albums I did for the National Lampoon with Michael O'Donoghue and Sean Kelly, a Canadian, And those were Radio Dinner and Lemmings, and then the missing White House tapes, the second two of which were both nominated for Grammys. So that's what we're after this time with Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight?
You know, the albums, they do kind of age like fine wine, and the fact that it's been 35 years, there's quite a legacy of stuff that you came out with before. With the passage of time and putting out a new album now, did that put added pressure on you guys to live up to the National Lampoon album name?
Well, yes. I mean, it certainly, since we're claiming to recreate or at least continue the glory days of the National Lampoon, but with the injustices and sensitivities and so on of the 21st century, yes, it is. It's a burden. But I like to think that with me at least keeping the sensibility of the group on track, so to speak, we have actually achieved that or got close enough to it to entertain people.
You know, with the internet, on another note, with the internet the way it is these days and social media, you've also created a fake news site, correct?
Yes, it's thefinaledition.com, yes. We actually launched it. We launched it 5 years ago in May of 2011 as a full-scale parody of the New York Times, in which the New York Times had just closed. In other words, it was the final edition of the New York Times. This was at a time when everyone was expecting the New York Times to actually possibly go under. So it was pretty hilarious, and about 100 people contributed to it with art and so forth, and we did it in conjunction with Slate, and it was a big hit. It got sort of millions of hits and so on. So having done that, we decided to call, or at least I decided to call, the whole website The Final Edition, and then that very soon became The Final Edition Radio Hour.
Mm. The reason why I bring that up is that,
yep.
Do you find nowadays with social media and people reposting things on Twitter and Facebook and everywhere else, that there are three crowds: the ones who truly enjoy satire, the ones who are aghast by what you guys do, and the ones
right.
who believe what they read and don't realize it is satire?
Yes, the last group is hilarious in itself, I must say. It is quite amazing how I mean, I cannot really put my finger on why it happens. But to some degree, I think it's because screens in general have bred in a certain type of people, certain type of person, I should say, a tremendous literalism about things, which is sort of the other side of believing that what happens on television is real life, which is and therefore, if you see something on a screen, and after all, the internet is basically just little television available to everybody. It's quite understandable then if you realize that that's what people believe, that they actually think that what you're doing is burning down the Times or whatever it might be. That's a very good point actually. And I don't know what you do about those people. You just put them on a huge desert island and forget about them, I think.
Well, that in itself becomes a reality show. The idea, also the absurdity of real life, does it make your job tougher as a satirist? For instance, watching the current political campaigns going on in the United States and trying to discern truth from fiction, how does that make your job as a satirist?
Well, I mean, I don't really subscribe to the view that it's impossible to satirize modern life because it's so extreme. I think the key is, for a good satirist, is to come at it in a way that diminishes those people who deserve to be diminished in new ways. So, for example, one of the things we're working on at the moment actually is that Trump is just a very bad comedian. And it's really, if you watch him, that's exactly what he's doing. It's like a really bad comedian at the open mic for the first time. He just happens to have a really friendly audience. And it's, I think there's going to be a very funny routine done out of that.
Absolutely.
But that's the kind of thing you have to do. You just have to be ingenious.
Well, the album, again, is out, and it's great, and it's well worth the wait, although, I'm not waiting another 35 years for another one. It's called Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight? People can get it by going to thefinaledition.com, correct?
Yes, you can also get it on iTunes, and you can get it on CD Baby. which soon will mean that CD Baby distributes to a lot of other channels too. But those two and FinalEdition.com, yes, they're the key places at the moment.
Tony, as someone who's been a fan of your work for a long time, it is an honor and a pleasure to have the chance to talk to you.
You too. Thank you so much indeed. Bye-bye.
Tony Hendra, the mastermind behind the new National Lampoon album, Are There Any Triggers Here Tonight? Again, you can find the new album at thefinaledition.com and also on iTunes and CD Baby. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0370, and you'll find the links.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll find out about the Olympic ambush competition and what that's all about. Plus, Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter. We have lots more Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. Here in a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get back to the stuff, boys and girls. 50-year-old Jeffrey Osella and his neighbor have had regular disputes for the last 13 years, says Interim Police Chief Sean Lacey in Westerly, New Hampshire. In the latest incident, the two got into a shouting match, and Osella allegedly responded by using a potato gun to shoot corn cobs at his neighbor's house. The neighbor told officers he had recently put his house up for sale, and he was concerned about Osella damaging the property or hindering a sale. Police went to Osella's house where, according to the report, he answered the door shirtless with several corn kernels stuck to his chest. He denied shooting at the neighbor, but allegedly admitted firing towards the neighbor's home. He was arrested on charges of disorderly conduct and firing in a compact area. So, police think there wasn't a kernel of truth in his statement, huh? Well, it's a corny story all the way around. Okay, I'll stop now. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police were called to a gas station in Penticton, British Columbia, on a report of a disturbance shortly before 2 a.m. Mounties arrived to find a man who had completely undressed. He was in excruciating pain and vigorously using his shirt to scrub his genitals with homogenized milk in an attempt to relieve the pain. Funny, I've never seen that used as a pain reliever, but I digress. The problem, the man was carrying his own can of bear spray, and it went off unintentionally, spraying its contents down the front of his pants, according to RCMP spokesperson Corporal Don Rigglesworth. It's probably not the first time he's had a burning sensation there. Anyway, you know, I'm reminded of that joke where the punchline from a talking bear is, "You don't come here for the hunting, do you?" Go on, look it up. I can't tell you what the joke's about. It's family radio. And a man driving by a church in West Palm Beach, Florida, saw a man throwing a firebomb at the Westgate New Testament Church and called police. The witness kept an eye on the man until responding deputies were able to capture 24-year-old Hector Luis Trujillo, who allegedly confessed to the crime. "I started the fire because the church has bad people. They are devil worshippers," he allegedly told the police. "I had to do something." Trujillo was charged with burglary and first-degree arson. Maybe a psychoval would be a good idea, too. Just tossing that in. I guess under the circumstances, he could have said, "The devil made him do it." Residents in downtown Milan, Italy, heard weird construction-like sounds at night. "We began hearing noises on Sunday evening," said one resident. "We were jokingly saying to each other, 'Are they robbing the bank?'" Indeed, the sounds got closer and closer to a neighborhood bank. "On Monday, one of us went to the bank to warn them about the tremors we had felt. Others went to the nearest police station on Tuesday because the sounds had not stopped. Bank and police officials blew off the warnings." That is, until bank employees arrived to find someone inside who forced them to open the safe and safety deposit boxes. The robbers escaped through their tunnel before police arrived. Yeah, if you see something, say something. But if you only hear something, apparently no one will listen to you, at least in Milan. Authorities say a robbery suspect somehow made off with a Terre Haute police car despite being handcuffed behind his back. Officers had placed 28-year-old Cody Tyrone of Terre Haute in the back of a patrol car. Police say that while unattended, Tyrone kicked out the metal screen separating the front and back seats, slid through the opening, and drove away. Police using GPS caught up with him elsewhere in Terre Haute. They say Tyrone rammed several squad cars that tried to block the stolen vehicle before he was again taken into custody. Police also say his hands were still restrained behind him. Tyrone was taken to Vigo County Jail and booked on charges including motor vehicle theft and battery of a law enforcement officer. Okay, is this guy double-jointed or what? When he gets out, he might get a call from Cirque du Soleil. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 68-year-old Michael O'Murphy went to a neighbor in Davidson Township, Michigan, to ask for a favor. "I got to get rid of this," Murphy told Dwayne Morish, "because it's starting to smell." He had tried to cut up the body of a man he had shot, but it had proven more difficult than he anticipated, and it was still in his garden shed. Could Morish help him dump the body in a county park? Morish figured Murphy was joking, but when he accepted the keys to the garden shed and took a look, he went to police. Murphy is charged with first-degree murder and faces life in prison. You know, this proves the axiom that I've always lived by. Good friends will help you move. Best friends will help you move a body. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? 4 years ago, with the London Olympics, we talked about the Olympic ambush competition. No, I'm not talking about some sort of terrorist plot. I'm talking about non-affiliated marketers who horn in on the advertising of the official sponsors. Back then, we talked to the folks at the Global Language Monitor who have tracked the Olympic ambush competition. So, how did the companies fare this time in this year's games in Rio? Well, once again, we are joined by Paul J.J. Payak to discuss it. He joins us via Skype from Austin, Texas. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how are you today? It's good to talk to you again, as always.
Good to talk to you as well. So here we are 4 years later. The last time we spoke to you, we spoke just before the London Games started. This time we're talking after the Rio Games have finished. So when you've crunched all the numbers and looked at all the data, what have you found as far as the Olympic ambush competition is concerned?
Well, Nike took the gold, as one might expect. Pepsi took the silver, and Siemens took the bronze. And those are pretty strong competitors, and there's a lot of money involved with them. We also, this year, created the economic value unit on how much money, how much worth of advertising they actually get by Ambersheen. And so somebody like Nike, it's about $400 million to sponsor an Olympiad, okay? So Tokyo, you know, starts now until the next 4 years, and Rio just ended their Olympiad. It was about $400 million for a major sponsor. So the fact that Nike beat all the major sponsors except Samsung is a lot of money.
Well,
it's an economic value that is quite large.
We should explain what we're talking about here. I did mention it briefly in the introduction, but basically you have a lot of official sponsors, and we know who they are. The Visas, the Coca-Colas, we know who the big sponsors are who sponsor the major Olympics, both
right,
on
called,
the...
They're called the top sponsors officially.
Yeah, and they're in terms of advertising, as in commercials, but also on site with signage, and their logo is everywhere, that kind of stuff. And then there are other companies...
They're on your McDonald's glasses when you buy a Coke for the next 5 years,
yeah,
or 4 years, and they're every place.
Then there are the companies who don't buy into the Olympics,
they don't pay the IOC, the Olympic Organizing Committee, the huge sums of money that the official top sponsors do.
So one of the ways that some of the ones that are, as you say, are the winners of the Olympic ambush competition, what are some of the ways that they get around paying the IOC anything but still getting their brand noticed?
Well, what they do is they're just present in, let's say, Pepsi. Pepsi will have marketing campaigns, a lot about people striving, you know, people winning, all things that are the Olympic ideals, but they won't say real Olympics. Okay, so a lot of the companies just associate themselves. Now, what happens is this Rule 40 that doesn't allow other competitors like Pepsi from using certain words. Like, they can't say Rio Olympics. And I know when it was Vancouver, it was really fun because it was the Winter Olympics, and you couldn't say, the word snow was outlawed. Okay, so you couldn't say snow and Olympics, because that was chosen as one of the laws that were to be outlawed. And it actually becomes like a bit of a game that the non-affiliated marketers or the ambushers try really hard to associate themselves with the games without violating Rule 40. And they do a great job at it. I mean, Nike, and then there's other ways that are kind of semi-legitimate. In other words, Nike sponsored the uniforms for the USA, the female gymnastic team, right? Now, that's pure gold, but they made sure that Nike had some sponsorship there. So you can take lesser sponsorships. I talked to someone from Nike. They said they have 40 people in China just looking for people to sponsor, you know, individual athletes and all. So you can do all that, so your name does get seen, okay? But you're not a top sponsor, which gives you all the credits and all. So there's clever ways to do it.
Now, there was a little bit of a bugaboo talk about, and by the way, when media talks about something, that in itself is gold for whomever they're talking about when they're supposedly either breaking the rules or getting around the rules. And there was the situation with Michael Phelps and the fact that he has a personal deal, I think it's with Armorall,
Under Armour,
and it's not one of the official sponsors. And of course, he keeps showing up on the podium. He keeps showing up wearing something that is not one of the officially sanctioned advertisers. But of course, that's absolute gold, because there he is standing around with a medal around his neck and his logo that is not one of the official ones.
Right, and actually, Under Armour took our award for the most promising newcomer And that award is actually a sheaf of wheat. You know, a sheaf of wheat because, you know, the Olympics, going back to their heritage and everything, things like sheaves of wheat and everything were considered pretty important. Anyhow, and so they had an economic value that we got to say it's got to be $300 million minimum. Okay, with Phelps and everything, they were very clever there. And that was the big news on, you know, who is there new that made a major breakthrough. And it's funny because, you know, in a World Cup a few years ago, there was the Vuvuzela. Remember the thing?
Yeah.
You know, there was everybody was Adidas had all certain uniforms where girls would sit in the stands, young women would sit in the stands and all wear their bright colors and things like that. And there was none of that. There were no stunts this year. Mm. Probably because the other thing that's really interesting about this year is how low the participation was from the media. I mean, for example, you don't hear this, of course, because everybody's just telling you how good it is and how it went up on Facebook. You know, like NBC will say, well, their Facebook hits went up by 6%. Yeah, but from London to now, Facebook didn't grow 6%. Facebook doubled. Okay, to have your hits go up 6% means you actually lost value.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this because the games, the next summer games, are going to be in Japan, and I would assume that perhaps, like a previous game that may have been in the United States, when it comes to Japan, that is a gold mine for some electronics companies that are based there. Are they really jockeying for position right now? Not the ones who are officially connected to the Olympics in 2020, but the ones who are jockeying for the Olympic ambush competition title.
Yes, actually, we started measuring Tokyo 2 years ago. Okay. And it's the regular faces, the regular people you're expecting to see. But we started measuring 2 years ago because that's when the competition starts. Okay? And so right now, it's the usual suspects, you know, leading. But I just want to say, if you're talking about the electronic company, the number one sponsor by far was Samsung from Korea.
Hmm.
And they have done a great job because they build the whole infrastructure for the Olympics, basically. And so you'll see all sorts of Samsung products and the infrastructure, too. But they are number one by a large extent. Let's just give you a number here. Is Nike came in number two at the brand affiliation index, how closely they're affiliated with the Olympic brand. That's our official study. And Samsung had a BAI of 363 points, which is very high. McDonald's, which is number two, had 136. Huh. So Samsung just crushed it. Nike, again, our ambush marketing winner, the gold medalist, was 237. So Nike was ahead of everybody except Samsung.
So tell me, when it comes to the official sponsors of the Olympic Games, are they annoyed by the idea that there are those who usurp their signage, their visage, by being Olympic ambush competition participants?
They are. They're always annoyed, and they're always aware of it. And the fact that we've created this new economic value unit, it tells how much value is being siphoned off from their nickel, will bring it even more to their attention.
Paul, it's always fascinating to have a chance to talk to you on the program. We should mention that people can go to your website, which is www.languagemonitor.com. That's languagemonitor.com, and they can see all of the statistics and all of the information that you have, which is very fascinating. Unfortunately, not enough time to go into all of it, but fascinating to look at the companies that pay officially to advertise through the Olympics and those who don't pay and how they get their bang for their buck as opposed to the officials. It's very interesting. I thank you once again, Paul, for being on the program with us.
Thanks for having me.
Paul J.J. Payak from Global Language Monitor. Again, you can visit their website at languagemonitor.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0370, and you'll find links to Paul's website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. With campaign season in high gear, I've been thinking about some of the most memorable statements that political leaders have delivered over the years. One of the most famous lines ever spoken would definitely be when Franklin Roosevelt declared, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." He believed fear was crippling America during the Great Depression. He also believed that the first step to overcoming that fear was to acknowledge its existence. Today, fear still cripples many aspects of American life. This time, however, it's the fear of being sued that often plagues Americans. In my weekly visits with you, I've shared examples of how that fear has affected everyone from doctors, manufacturers, and teachers to charities, community parks, and many others. We've even heard about how the fear of being sued led one person to refuse to give CPR to a coworker dying before her eyes. Let's be fair. The good news is that we have the power to eliminate this problem. But first, policymakers have to admit that it exists. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses. But recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here he is, complete with his water wings, Stuart Nauman. Hi, well, Stu.
Hi, Peter. Well, you know, I just can't get into the pool without those reliable, floatable water wings.
Yeah, because you'll drown even in the shallow end.
Yeah. And it's been proven, actually. It's happened. Yes. And I have those old-fashioned water wings, not the inflatable ones, the ones with the styrofoam inside, like those styrofoam donuts inside the water
yeah,
wings.
Yeah, right.
Got those. And why are we mentioning pools and swimming pools and all that and water wings? Well, because in this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at a book about a swimmer, an Olympic swimmer. Because you know what? 40 years ago, I was one of the many Montrealers who really got caught up in the flurry and excitement of the 76 Summer Olympics. I was at the opening ceremonies at the Olympic Stadium, and I watched a lot of the coverage on both ABC and CBC. And throughout those 16 days of glory, three names were always mentioned who constantly dominated the spotlight at the 76 Olympics. They were Nadia Comaneci, Bruce Jenner, and Shirley Babashoff. Now, the first two names are well-known for obvious reasons, but as for Babashoff, she was the champion freestyle swimmer and world record holder who won three medals at the 1972 Summer Olympics in Munich and was touted to win a slew of individual gold medals in the pool 4 years later in Montreal. However, something happened during those individual swimming competitions at the Olympic pool, and it was in the form of the women's Olympic swimming team from East Germany. They somehow appeared to be more stronger and muscular in appearance than any of their female swimming counterparts. And they virtually tore up the pool with every race they competed in, practically winning the lion's share of the gold medals. They proved to be no match for Babashoff, who ended up winning four individual silver medals and scored a personal victory when, as a member of the U.S. women's relay team, they beat the East Germans and won the gold medal in the 4x100 relay. But something about the way the East German women swimmers appeared and their somewhat superhuman performance in the pool seemed to bother Babashoff a great deal. She was suspicious that the swimmers were winning their gold medals not through the merit of years and hours of hard work and practice like she did, but through constant doping using illegal performance-enhancing drugs. So when Babashoff decided to go to the media and voice her opinion about why the East Germans really won so many swimming gold medals, she was accused of poor sportsmanship for picking on the poor, defenseless East Germans, and instead of being regarded as a game changer who first shed light on the worldwide illegal doping of athletes, both amateur and professional, she was viewed as a bitter individual and was given the nickname Surly Shirley by a rather unforgiving sports press corps. And now more than 40 years later, Shirley Babashoff tells her story as a revered champion swimmer and a pioneering whistleblower when it comes to sports doping in her engaging memoir, Making Waves. Now, what I enjoyed about the book is Babashoff's tone, which is a combination of honesty, wide-eyed fascination, graciousness, and dogged determination. You get a first-hand look at what the rigors of a professional swimmer goes through in order to remain competitive, not to mention what an Olympic athlete goes through before, during, and after their respective competitions. And Babashoff deserves a great deal of credit for her bravery to expose the world to the widespread doping of East German athletes that was approved by the state nearly 20 years before the truth really came out and many athletes and administrators confessed to the doping. Now, Babashoff was proven right and somewhat vindicated, but to her it wasn't enough for all the shunning she had to endure through those 20 years. Now, in fact, she adamantly wants the International Olympic Committee to rectify the situation for those swimmers who lost out to the East Germans in 1976 by revising those results and award medals to those swimmers who would have finished in first, second, or third place without the aid of doping, which is included in towards the end of the book. And so far, her proposal has fell upon deaf ears from the IOC. So all in all, Making Waves is a fascinating, complete testament to a true Olympian who showed extraordinary skills in the pool and raw courage outside it. And after reading this book, you have to feel that Shirley Babashoff should not be treated as a bitter pariah, but as a true Olympic hero and role model for future generations of athletes who want to follow in her footsteps and the footsteps of other Olympic champions.
Excellent, excellent stuff indeed. And full disclosure, this book is co-written by Chris Epting, who is a friend of both this show, and you know him well as well. We've interviewed Chris on this program several times and on the old radio show, and he has written several books in his own right. As a matter of fact, he's a very prolific writer, so this is just the latest that he has churned out, this one along with Shirley Babashoff.
Oh, yeah, and he's quite the prolific author and pop culture historian. Anything that he puts out is always going to be fascinating.
Everything he puts out, to use an Olympic term, is gold.
Yes.
Everything he puts out is gold.
And I don't think he shows any signs of slowing.
Absolutely, absolutely. By the way, you mentioned how you were at the opening ceremonies and you followed the Olympics on ABC. I didn't get to see any of those things, unfortunately. I was too busy. I was working at the Olympics.
Oh, were you?
At Molson Stadium, where field hockey was, selling souvenirs every day.
Oh, really? I hope you sold a lot of souvenirs back then.
Oh, yes. I was on commission. I made sure I did.
Well, people like to buy souvenirs no matter which year or what Olympics you went to.
We're going back 40 years, so I'll give you an idea of prices. I was trying to push because I was, and you'd appreciate this because you like books. You remember the coffee table full-size Olympic album?
Oh, yeah.
That book sold for $40 back then. And there was major coin to be had if you sold any of those.
Did you sell at least one?
Oh, I sold more than one.
Oh, yeah, and also the programs and the T-shirts and the pins and the hats. So, yeah, it's I wonder if people held on to them now because Olympic souvenirs are, you know, very valuable.
I still have a few pins because I bought some of the pins myself, the ones I was selling.
Oh, yeah?
And I traded them. Because that's what people used to do. They still do. They trade pins with other people who want pins. Since I had a cachet of them, I could buy them literally for myself at wholesale prices. And trade them. So that's what I did.
Well, I still have my Olympic program books, for one for the opening ceremonies. Still have it. And also, my dad went to the boxing events. He went to one of the events where Leon Spinks won the gold medal. And I still have it. I have that boxing program book as well. So I got my share of them, too.
Excellent.
Not pins like you, but hey, we all have our piece of the 76 games.
Anyway, what other books do you recommend in the vein of what you just described, the book about Shirley Babashoff?
Well, I thought I'd go about, books about Olympics, the Olympics. And two really came to mind. First was Three Ring Circus by Jack Ludwig. He's a Canadian reporter and journalist. He did one of the first books about the 76 Games, which was published about 1977, about what went on behind the scenes planning the 76 Olympics. And another one called Rome 1960 by David Moranis. Moranis is an excellent author and sports reporter. He's written biographies about Vince Lombardi and Roberto Clemente. In this book, he basically argues that the 1960 Summer Olympics in Rome was one of the first modern Olympics, was the first Olympics that was broadcast regularly on television via satellite. Also, a groundbreaking Olympics for athletes like Wilma Rudolph and, you know, Cassius Clay and Bibi Bakila. So this was it's probably one of the best books about a single Olympics. Rome 1960 by David Moranis.
And this week's book is?
It's called Making Waves by Shirley Babishoff with Chris Epting, published by Santa Monica Press, and it's $32.50.
And how can people find you?
Well, not the Olympic pool, because I don't think they use that anymore, but if or any municipal pool, because I don't have my water wings right now. But you can find me in the Montreal Times every week, every Saturday, in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
Thank you, and hey, thanks Shirley Babishoff for making quite a splash, no pun intended.
Absolutely. Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments. And I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you, but I just want to say a quick word about Alita Hair Products of Beverly Hills. You know, many hair products contain harmful ingredients that can damage your hair and scalp. At Alita Hair, their policy is to use only great natural ingredients without harmful chemicals. All Alita hair products are made in the U.S. and are not, I repeat, not tested on animals. They're safe, healthy, natural, and luxurious, but not at the usual high salon prices. Now, listeners of the Stuff File program, you have a special offer. Visit Alita Hair at their website at alitahair.com. That's E-L-I-T-A-hair.com. And when you purchase Alita Hair products, use the promo code STUFF10. That's STUPH10. That'll get you a 10% discount on your purchase. That's promo code STUFF10. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0370, and you'll find the promo code and the link near the bottom of the page. There you go. And the Stuff File program, of course, is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, the punishment for a portly New Jersey pizza man who finished last in his fantasy football league included a very public walk of shame and a pair of women's underwear. 42-year-old Angelo Biomio marched down the roadway in Toms River wearing only pink women's bikini bottoms and sneakers while hoisting a sign signifying his fantasy football misfortune. The pizza owner strolled along Highway or Route 9 for 10 minutes on Labor Day, inducing hilarity and horror in pedestrians and motorists alike. Angelo told the New York Post that people honked their horns and a woman with four children in her minivan drove back and forth five times as the kids laughed at his display. He says police also called his business to tell them they were getting calls from concerned citizens. Okay, you know, I've seen this video. This guy is large and hairy. It was like seeing Bigfoot in panties. I'm glad the children in the minivan found it amusing, because the other option would have been years of therapy for them. Yeah. Anyway, we're at that juncture in the program, folks, the end of the program, where we share with you what you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
47-year-old Boyd Wiley was arrested in August when he walked into the Putnam County, Florida Sheriff's Office and, apparently in all seriousness, demanded that deputies return the 91 marijuana plants they had unearthed from a vacant lot in the town of Interlaken several days earlier. Until that moment, deputies did not know whose plants they were. Wiley was told that growing marijuana was illegal in Florida and was arrested. Okay, this guy is Hall of Fame dumb, because why would you waltz into a police station demanding the return of your 91 pot plants when the cops didn't even know whose they were? Well, one reason, and one reason only: you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0370. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0370. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.